Financial support for WICN and programs like Inquiry come from listeners like yourself. So please take a moment to consider becoming a member now by pledging online at WICN.org. Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Julie Favell, writer, historian, and fellow of the Royal Historical Society. And we're talking about her latest book, When London Was the Capital of America. Julie, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much. Thank you for inviting me.
This was a really fabulous history, a really interesting history. And as you write in your introduction, you're really interested about how Britons and Americans began to think of each other as separate people. And through most of this book, that isn't happening yet, is it?
No, that's right. That's right. In fact, to start, researching this book was a surprise to me. I started out wanting to write a travel history about colonial Americans in England before the Revolution to explore how they saw their mother country just before independence at this kind of pivotal time.
Mm.
But travel histories really hang on testimonies people leave about the differences they find when they're abroad, the comparisons they make. And what I was surprised to find was that there was very, very little of this in the letters and diaries I was looking at. And then I realized that this really was a story about people who weren't foreign yet at all. They were more like 19th century Americans, say from the Midwest, coming to New York City for the first time.
It doesn't even sound that bad. Like when you compare Scots in London at the time, which you do in the book, it seemed like Londoners really didn't like Scots and sort of singled them out. And it seemed that people from America felt very much at home. First of all, there were a lot of Americans living in London at that time, and we'll talk about what they were doing, but there was an entire American culture already ensconced in London at this time. And I want to mention, we're talking about oftentimes about the time period between the Seven Years' War, which I think here in America we call the French and Indian War,
yeah,
and the War of American Independence. So we're talking really close to that time period where America's going to sever ties with Britain, yet there are a lot of Americans living there.
Yeah, oh, absolutely, yes. I estimated that there were about 1,000 wealthy Americans living there. This would be families who could afford to live over there as absentees. And that included, at that time, West Indians were counted as Americans. And there would have also been ordinary Americans whose numbers are harder to hit upon. But there were merchants. There were people coming over as milliners, doing all kinds of small business, people coming in to buy shopwares. And then there were the sailors, of course, the merchant seamen, both black and white, who came and went to the London docks all the time. So there were thousands of Americans in London at any one time during that period.
And this is not unusual because the reality is London was one of the great capitals of the Northern Hemisphere, of the world at that point in time. And there was not at that time an American city that could compare for what London could offer.
Yes, absolutely. The American cities were comparable to English cities like Norwich or Bristol that maybe only had 30,000, 40,000 people in them. So if you really wanted that big city feel and the critical mass that cities provide in terms of publishing, the arts, so on and so forth, then London was where people had to go.
The thing I love about your history is that it's really based on very personal histories. You get to know specific people in your book. How did you dig out these histories?
I partly had to base it on the papers that were there, and that was one of the big challenges, is that there were a lot of Americans living there, but if you go and look for, you know, people who've really left meaty records of letters and diaries of what they were doing, how they felt about it, that's a bigger challenge. And the biggest challenge of all was absolutely the slave Robert Scipio.
Oh, yeah.
Because he's the only person in the book who, with the exception of the very end, never speaks in his own words. I had to write his history entirely through the letters of his master, Henry Lawrence, who, to an unusual extent, mentioned his slave in letters home. And then also by reconstructing the physical environment he was in and what was going on in the city, so that I wasn't telling the story entirely from Henry's own words.
And this brings up a whole very complex issue, and that is how American black slaves were viewed in London at that period in time. Now, let's start with the family of Henry Lawrence. Was a South Carolina planter, very wealthy. And as you make it clear in your book, if you were wealthy and you were in America, your sons would go to school in Britain. And they would go to some of the finest British schools that actually still exist. And that was considered to be what a rich person did, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Now, when you went there, you brought your personal slave with you. Now, what was the British idea of slavery at that point in time?
The British at this time, the anti-slavery movement that was going to become such a powerful movement in Britain really didn't get going until after the American Revolution in the late 1780s. The British attitude in the 1760s and 70s, which is when I'm writing about, was still kind of unformed and nebulous. People couldn't make up their minds. There were more and more enslaved people of African origin in London at that time. Some of them were African Americans. Some of them were the offspinnings of the slave trade because London was a big slave port. And the way Londoners responded to this is that some of them jumped in and bought and sold slaves. And you can find this in the newspapers, advertisements for slaves, advertisements for slave boys for sale who used to help out in a pub but aren't wanted anymore because the business is moving on and so forth. Some of it quite really taking slavery very much for granted. And at the same time, there were other people who were appalled because, particularly after the Seven Years' War, the number of black slaves appearing in the streets, partly because more American planters were coming with slaves, was growing. And people started seeing some very unlovely sights in the streets. For example, slaves who were resisting being brought back to the colonies, being forcibly taken up in chains in the streets, and so on and so forth.
As you mentioned, slaves were being beaten in London, but and this is fairly subtle here as you describe it, but the practice was not respectable. And so if you cared at all about what Londoners did, what did you do? Beat your slave behind closed doors? I mean that's
well,
sort of sounded...
The thing about it is that, basically, American slave owners did sometimes complain that the rigor necessary to exact obedience from slaves on the plantation wasn't practicable in London, to use 18th century language.
Oops.
And that was to a large extent what they meant. But having said that, white London servants were still sometimes abused and beaten to death in the 18th century.
This is a fascinating discussion you have in your book, is servants versus slaves in Georgian London. Let's spend a moment. Like, what was the situation for servants in Georgian London, and how were they treated, and what class of people were they?
Well, London servants could come from all sorts of backgrounds, and it really depended. And it depended on... Servants had their own hierarchy. It was quite complicated. If you worked for a nobleman, you had a higher status as a servant. If you worked for a member of the gentry, you were a bit lower, but still, if you worked for a city merchant or somebody who didn't seem quite as genteel, you had less status. And then, of course, in small households, they might simply have a maid of all work or some lowly person who had very little status. And amongst the servants themselves, all kinds of people went into service then. You did sometimes get people with educated backgrounds going in as, upstairs house servants in well-to-do homes. But you'd also get people coming in from the country wanting to move to London because of the attractions and hoping they could get a job as a maid or whatever.
Now, there's a lot of literature and a lot of talk about servants, being very impudent and very tough to control. And they seem to be a lot more independent than the American slaves would be in London. Is that true? Were they more on a footing? Were the American slaves more on a footing with the British servants?
Well, in the book, I talk about how Robert achieved a kind of solidarity with the servants in the house he was staying in. There was a surprising willingness at that time for the so-called lower orders of London to mix with African servants and even to marry African servants. The kind of racism that became dominant in Britain in the 19th century really doesn't seem to have taken as much hold then. And within a few months of getting to London, Henry Lawrence was complaining that Robert wouldn't get up early to light the fire or serve breakfast. He actually said, the servants, he said, there's a universal practice in London of sitting up late at night and getting up late in the morning, which wasn't the case back on the plantation. So he said, I have to lie in bed for hours and I'd gladly be up, but the servants, even my black servant, would all comply with the fashion. If I quitted my bed, it must be to starve in a cold room. So that gives you, you know, it gives you this funny image of this powerlessness of this man who's wealthy. He's of the gentrified classes in London, and he even, one of the servants is even his slave, and he can't get any of them to get up and, you know, light his fire and get him his breakfast. So actually, I think that a lot of African-American slaves who came to London found that they were able to, you know, bond up with a lot of the white servants and really behave much as them. And in fact, one of the complaints that some plantation owners had about American slaves when they came to London was that they became corrupted by the other servants around and started demanding wages, if you can imagine.
Now, in a situation like this, it would seem to me that a lot of slaves would then want to escape slavery while they were in England. And you mentioned that there are sort of three routes, and I want to talk about each in turn. They could get wages and certify their free status. Can you explain what that would be?
Well, that would just be a case of the big distinction between being a slave and a free person was whether you were paid for what you did. There are court cases where, you know, a black person in London is accused of a crime, and during the testimony he says, I'm a free man, I'm paid wages. So if you could get people to start paying you wages, you might be able to go before a magistrate and say, you know, I'm now a free man. Although none of these ways out of slavery were absolutely foolproof.
And also marry an English person, and then most likely would be, what, another a servant or something like that they would bond with. And then once they married an English person, they then have British rights?
If they married an English person, it would just simply become very impractical for the master to then force them out of the kingdom. There were quite a number of cases of English women marrying black African men of African descent in Georgia and England. This was kind of commented on with disgust by not only some white plantation owners, but some white Englishmen of the upper classes. But in fact, there's a suggestion that the English women found them quite attractive, perhaps exotic.
Huh. And you also mentioned they could just simply run away. Was there equivalent of an underground railroad for escaped slaves in Britain?
Oh, no, absolutely not. If they ran away, they were on their own. And one of the big problems about running away, I mean, it sounds so easy, and you might think, well, why didn't Robert run away? But in fact, in London, quite a few people starved to death in the streets every week. It was some magistrate estimated that 20 people starved to death a week. Whether that's accurate or not, I don't know. And it was a very harsh environment if you didn't have any money, if you didn't have a job. People who weren't Londoners would not qualify for parish aid. So that would obviously include slaves, but it would also include people from the English countryside who weren't members of a London parish. So if you ran away, you really had to have a plan. You could starve to death, or you could be recaptured by people associated with your master, by your master, or by people who'd been paid to recapture slaves, because there was a business going like that in London, and you could find yourself right back where you'd started. So you really needed a place to hide as well.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Julie Flavelle, writer, historian, and fellow of the Royal Historical Society. And we're talking about her latest book, A Wonderful History, When London Was the Capital of America. Julie, well, what's really unfortunate is you have this incredible character of Scipio, and you just lose there are just no records after a certain point in time, and we don't know what really happened to him.
No, that's right. I felt very fortunate to be able to discover what happened to him to the extent that I did, actually. The original Henry Lawrence papers have been published, and the editors couldn't find out what happened to him, but I uncovered the rest of his story in a Shrewsbury newspaper from the 1770s. This is a plot spoiler. Would you like me to tell it?
Go ahead. Go for it.
Okay. Basically, Henry and Robert, as his name, because he changed his name to Robert when he came to London in order to anglicize it, and Henry went along with this. So Henry and Robert had a kind of an increasing power struggle over the years in London, where Robert, you know, apparently went his own way as much as he could, and Henry complained about him more and more in the letters. And eventually, Henry banished him a lot of the time to a house in Shropshire, which is still standing. I was excited to find, and I have a picture of it in the book, which was, this house was owned by some people called the Austens, who had also been in South Carolina and been slave owners and involved in the slave trade. And they kept Robert with them in the countryside for a lot of the time, partly, I think, to keep him off Henry's back. And something happened up there, because at some point, the Austens wrote to Henry and said, look, Robert's been arrested for burglary, burglaring the very house he was in. And they also mentioned bigamy, which means that Robert had some kind of sweetheart up there in Shropshire, and she must have been married, because Robert certainly wasn't. And Henry was absolutely furious about this, and it got into the newspapers that this blackamoor had been arrested breaking into this house. And in the newspapers, his name was given as John Morton, and this is certainly just a changing of his name to protect the family's privacy when the case went up to court. And Henry suggested, what's fascinating about this story is that, I mean, you might think that at this point Henry would be glad to see the back of Robert. He was a young man. He was a troublesome, restless young man who clearly wasn't happy in Henry's service, and Henry was thinking about going back to America now. But instead, he just wouldn't give up, because basically Henry Lawrence was a man who considered himself to be a righteous man and a moral man. He realized slavery was wrong, but he believed that his slaves were happy in his service, and the fact that Robert kept trying to get away really bothered him. And so what he said was, he said, okay, if he's transported, if transportation is a sentence, that is, he's sent back to the colonies, I will go to the Crown officers and offer to pay for the transportation and have him sent straight back to South Carolina, and that's it. He'll be my slave again. But what happened instead was that because the theft had been a very slight one, the judge decided it wasn't worth transporting him. He wasn't going to be hanged either, which happened with surprising frequency in Georgian England. Instead, he was just going to be sent to jail for a year. So Henry lost him forever, because Henry had to go back to South Carolina because the American Revolution was starting up, and he was going to play an important role in that. And Robert disappeared from the records after that, with the exception of appearing in the Old Bailey in 1777. There he was. I was just amazed to find him there. He had actually come to London. He'd obviously gotten out of jail. He was in London looking for a job as a servant, and he'd been robbed by someone, and he'd brought this woman up before the magistrates, and the case was found in his favor, and she was sentenced to a whipping. And that's the last I could find of him. But it was kind of sad, you know, because he really was an interesting person.
Oh, he's a fascinating
enterprise.
A totally fascinating character that really points out the connections and the distinctions between America and Britain, too. I mean, he's really a central figure in that relationship between the two countries.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that the when you look at the American colonies from the perspective of George and London, without looking at them through the filter of a kind of post-independence American nationalism, it's clear, you know, especially considering stories like Robert's story and how Londoners looked at Americans, that they did see them as mixed race. It's clear that America's British heritage is not a simple story of Anglo-Saxon roots.
Not at all.
Instead, it's about a very diverse people who came from all parts of the 18th century British Empire, including Africa. And this is how Georgian Londoners saw the colonists.
Well, changing gears entirely, one of the things I loved about the book is when these North Americans are going to school their young sons in London, how some of them get very worried about the temptations that are in London.
Oh, yes.
And the temptations were, I mean, compared to what was going on in the, depending upon what was going on in the, you know, the colonies, boy, London was like the potential for going way astray. Talk about that. I mean, there was all sorts of stuff that you could get into while you're in London.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, for one thing, London was supposed to have more prostitutes than any other city in Europe.
And it seemed everybody got to go to use the services of the prostitutes in your book.
I mean, they lined the streets. They were very brazen. And even the French commented on it. They said, one Frenchman wrote back to a friend saying, they come up to you and take hold of you in a manner I don't want to describe. and so they were these very brazen prostitutes who were in all, you know, found in all parts of the city. And there were all sorts of things that you either couldn't get in the colonial cities, or you certainly couldn't get them as easily. There were the plays. There were places like Vauxhall Gardens. Oh. There were all kinds of attractions, and there was a whole lifestyle in the coffee houses, which the colonial cities only had a pale imitation of.
I love these coffee houses as you describe them, because that was really the place where people met, discussed, hung out, and socialized. And there were numerous coffee houses in London, but that seemed like where the social life really transacted.
Oh, yes. I mean, the coffee houses, in the 18th century, the coffee houses were really, really vibrant places. People went in there, and they argued about politics, they conducted business, they picked up their mail, they used the coffee houses as offices. But if you used them as an office, you had to put up with the fact that people were playing cards and dice on the table right next to you. And they also still, in the 18th century, all ranks of people could go into most coffee houses. So you'd sometimes have, you know, highwaymen striding into coffee houses that were frequented by well-to-do Londoners. And that was something that was going to be slowly filtered out late in the century and in the 19th century as these places became more exclusive. But in the 18th century, it really was, you know, anything goes.
It's interesting. Some North American wealthy landowners decided that maybe London was too dangerous a place to send their children, so they would send them off to Switzerland, which really, at that point in time, really sounded like a drag. Like, if I was a young boy, I would not want to be sent off to school in Switzerland.
Yeah, I think that's right. Geneva was supposed to be a place where you couldn't get into as much trouble. And in fact, the English well-to-do were also interested in sending their sons there for the same reason. And Henry Lawrence sent his son John there for that very reason.
Now, things get very, very complex politically in your book, where there are British radicals who side with the American concerns. And it gets to be a very complex political relationship that's going on between London and America. And there are people like John Wilkes, who is an incredibly complex character and very interesting and strange, who used sort of the excuse of parliamentary reform to also side with the concerns of the colonists.
Yes, that's right, yes. John Wilkes was a figure who embodied this kind of feeling at that period that it was high time that the system of representation in Parliament be reformed, because there were the famous rotten boroughs at that time, villages that only had three people living in them that still got to send an MP, and then booming cities like Birmingham that had little or no representation. And so it was high time for some kind of reform, and Wilkes kind of embodied what was a growing middle class concern with this. But he also was willing to get allies wherever he could, and there were a lot of American activists, both in the colonies and in London, who felt that this really chimed in with what was happening in America, where Americans were being taxed by a parliament that they didn't have any representation in. And so the whole thing could be packaged up as a corrupt parliament that was trampling on English rights on both sides of the Atlantic.
There was even an American who was imprisoned in the Tower of London.
Yeah, although that was a very strange story.
That was a wild story.
To see Stephen Sayre as a martyr. Stephen Sayre was a very unusual figure who came from a farming community on Long Island and wanted to be a gentleman in a way that always reminds me of Defoe's Moll Flanders.
Yeah.
And he used every trick he could, quite literally, to go about appearing as a gentleman in London, to climb up the ladder in terms of politics, and eventually he became a crony of John Wilkes's. Now, a lot of John Wilkes's politics was a kind of theater. There's nothing he liked better than getting in some kind of trouble with the authorities that made the authorities look bad. And what happened to Stephen Sayre was that he was arrested a few months into the revolution on the most ridiculous charge of being involved in a plot to kidnap King George III and lock him up in the Tower and then spirit him out of the kingdom. And this he had spoken about this to another American who actually was in the British Army and serving in London. And this American felt obligated to go to his commanding officer, and then he was brought before a cabinet minister who took the whole thing very seriously. Then Sayre was eventually arrested and locked up, and then, of course, nothing happened. There was no uprising, and the ministry was made to look very stupid, as if they were heavy-handed and a bit silly, over-worried about conspiracies. And to this day, nobody really knows what lay behind it, but the thought is that it may have been a hoax, and it was a deliberate attempt to embarrass the ministry, which it certainly did.
We only have a few minutes left, and we can't possibly do this justice that it's done in your book, but Benjamin Franklin in London is a fascinating, complex, and nuanced figure. Not like I think most Americans understand Franklin at all. And what I was most touched by is that when problems started happening back in North America, there was really a sense of trying to find some kind of middle solution so that there would still be a close relationship between Britain and America. And that went for people like Franklin, too.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Franklin was originally devoted to the British Empire. In fact, he was a visionary in that he believed that one day that there'd be more English, and I say the word advisedly, English people living in America than in England. And he was quite at ease with the idea that the balance of power would shift over to America, but that both countries would be making one another great.
That's right.
But he always thought, too, that Britain in the long run was going to need America that bit more than America was going to need Britain, because America was expanding at such a rate. And he really didn't want independence at all until the very last. And what he hoped to do was to come up with some kind of last-minute solution whereby perhaps Britain and America could remain united under the crown. It was really a kind of an anticipation of the Commonwealth-style relationship
that Britain was going to
adopt in the 19th century.
Exactly right. We're completely out of time. We could be talking for hours more about this book. And my guest tonight has been Julie Flavel, writer, historian, and fellow of the Royal Historical Society. And we're talking about her latest book, which is just a great history, When London Was the Capital of America. Julie, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.